Podmoth.
If you're easily offended, this show may not be for you.
But if you're into that weird fun sh**, you've come to the right place.
You've been warned.
Are you there?
I'm Chris. I'm the believer.
I'm Cody. I'm the skeptic. Okay, stories. Let's get into it.
Hello! Welcome to BSP Believer Skeptic Podcast.
The podcast where two idiots debate weird phenomena.
I'm Chris, I'm the believer.
I'm Cody, I'm the skeptic.
And if this is your first time listening to us, we're an LGBTQ paranormal comedy podcast, and we are proud members of the Podmoth Network, and this is a full episode.
Hey! That was perfection. I thought about interrupting to like mess it up. So, what is a full episode, you ask? Well, we will come up with a paranormal topic every other week, and we are going to share some fun history and stories and information. And then we go into our believer skeptic portion where I debunk the crap out of it while Chris talks about why people believe.
And if you listen to the minisode prefacing this, if you guess Rome, Italy, that is incorrect.
That's what I'm hoping people will guess, is Rome, Italy.
Definitely is not. But our topic this week is religious relics. So.
Yeah. And if you listen real, because you said it pretty quick. If you listen to the minisode Chris's story, he's like,
intentionally, and
I
relics.
I knew it. He goes, little relics. I knew it. I'm breaking shit because I'm laughing. That's so funny.
I did that intentionally.
I knew it. But yeah, if you guessed it, good for you. And
Because that story had relics, shadow people, like all kinds of shit.
It could have been 18 different topics, but it was great. And I think, this episode is, we've talked about aspects of it for a while. I think it's going to be great. I found a story that is ridiculous. So
it's bigger, longer, and uncut.
Perfect clue. We have an episode title now.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're going to use this, but do you know what I typed for a title?
What?
Relic Leaky Maka.
Oh, no. No.
Then I'm leaving this so people can hear the brilliance.
Anywho.
So, and this isn't just Christian relics either.
Oh, no, absolutely not. That's why I said religious relics.
Yeah, well done.
Because Christianity is not the only religion.
That is
despite
true.
Despite what most people believe.
No, both of my stories are about Christianity. But a lot of it's about my upbringing, too. But I know that one of yours isn't.
No. So, drinks? Oh, is your drink that
awful?
Fucking terrible?
Let me just get it out of the way.
Yeah.
Okay, so I get to blame Chris for this one. Because Chris, literally, I was really thinking up really hard about this.
That's a lie.
And Chris,
that is a lie.
Well, I was thinking about this. And Chris was like, you could just bring red wine, because like the Holy Grail. And I was like, oh, I could just bring red wine. And Chris was very, very kind. So whenever he was visiting Mexico, he brought back a red table wine.
That's from New Mexico. Thank you very much.
Oh, from New Mexico. I'm sorry. And it looks delicious. I've been wanting an excuse to open it. And I also like that it has table, because, Jesus and the apostles sat together at a table. And I want to drink this. So that is what I'm going to do.
That is terrible.
So red wine, Holy Grail.
All right. So for mine, I think this is the most perfect drink that I have ever gotten.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because he said,
a show.
He sent a typo and he said it's the breeziest drink.
Yeah.
And I thought he was talking about summer.
No. So this is a non-alcoholic malt beverage. It's a golden wheat and it is called Heavenly Body Golden Wheat.
Wow, okay, that is perfect.
Yeah.
Even the name Golden is amazing. It's very pretty.
It says here, miraculously balanced between flavor and lightness, near beer from heaven.
Oh my God, Heavenly Body.
Yeah.
And that is perfect. That's the perfect one. It's almost as perfect as my Roadrunner Red Sweet Table Wine, but it's still pretty good.
Uh-oh. It tastes like a flat beer.
Oh, a flat beer?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's the malty. Oh, okay.
It's fine.
It tastes a little flat. But the taste and aftertaste are actually fine. It's pretty. It's very light.
Yeah. But this is not an alcohol tasting podcast.
It is not.
So, history. Relic is a religious object that can sometimes consist of the physical remains of a saint or their personal property. And as you'll learn, it's not just saints, but pretty much any holy person. Relics are very important in a number of religions, such as Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, and many, many others.
Yeah.
The origin of the word relic comes from two Latin words. Bear with me here because I tried looking these up and it's hard to find Latin. So.
Yeah, I don't think there's not Google voice for Latin.
No.
Modicum ostrum.
For two Latin words, reliquiae, which literally means remains, and relinquere, which means to leave behind or abandon, which I also assume is the same root as relinquish.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
When such relics are collected, they are often placed in a shrine known as a reliquary. Relics are, as you probably can guess, been around for thousands of years. Don't I always say that?
They've been around for 7 years. Yeah.
For example, in ancient Greece, cities or sanctuaries would claim to possess relics as part of a hero cult. Some objects that were displayed in sanctuaries included spears, shields, and other weapons.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's cool.
Bones and skulls were not looked at as...
Wouldn't that also be considered a museum?
Not if you have a shrine to it, rather than like in a museum.
Okay, yeah. That's true.
So bones and skulls were not looked at as relics, even if they came from a hero, as miracles were not always attributed to them.
Ah.
Instead, their remains were looked at as a form of protection.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Although Hinduism does have relics, they are not as common as they are in other religions, since the remains of most saints are cremated. One exception being that of the preserved body of Swami Ramanuja. In Buddhism, there are different relics of the Buddha, but also other sages as well. Sage is someone who has reached enlightenment in Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
After the Buddha passed, his remains were then divided into 8 portions. Each were placed in stupas, which is a building that is created specifically for relics wherever the religion was spread to. Some of the Buddha's original remains apparently still survive, one example being the relic of the tooth of the Buddha in Sri Lanka, which I will touch on more later.
I was about to be like, I want to hear more about that.
Aside from the Buddha, other stupas hold ashes of other well-respected cremated Buddhists. Relics are important to Buddhists because for them, it shows that enlightenment is possible and as a reminder that the Buddha was in fact a real person.
Oh, I love it.
I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's super cool.
In Christianity, relics are mentioned throughout the Bible. For example, in 2 Kings chapter 13, verses 20 and 21, some Israelites placed a man's deceased body in Elisha's tomb only for him to come back to life after touching Elisha's bones.
Oh, I did not know this story.
In Acts 19, verses 11 through 12, there is discussion of Paul's handkerchiefs, which were given healing power by God. And of course,
blow your nose in this. I feel better.
Of course, there are a number of instances in which people were healed after touching Jesus's garments.
Oh, yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
But is it considered a relic if you're alive and healing people?
Not then.
Okay.
But after the fact, if it's found and housed.
Yes, okay.
Yes, yeah.
I gotcha.
I think back then it's just called clothes.
I got a little dizzy, if you will.
Regarding relics, many people will travel a long way in order to be able to see them. In Christianity, Rome became one of these major destinations, as Europeans often had easier access to Rome versus the Holy Land.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point, actually.
Another major pilgrimage destination is Santiago de Compostela in Spain, which supposedly holds the relics of James the Apostle. In 2012 alone, around 200,000 people, both religious and non-religious, traveled to that site.
Damn.
We actually have one such pilgrimage site in New Mexico called El Santuario de Chimayo, which is about 10 minutes from my house. Every year on Good Friday, people, mostly Catholics, will make a pilgrimage there. That being said, medieval Christians believe that the saints would protect and intercede on their behalf by venerating the relics, and that's why they did it. So in order not to have to make such pilgrimages, relics were venerated locally. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Relics were utilized for a number of reasons, such as curing the ill, to take oaths, or to seek intercession for relief from evils of the world, you know. Reliquaries, as I stated previously, are used to protect and display the relics. This can, of course, be in the form of a casket, but there are other forms as well. I don't talk about that, but there is a lot of different housing and things that they do for them, you know. Being that relics were so highly prized, so to speak, their reliquaries often were covered in gold, silver, jewels, and so on. In the Middle Ages, ivory was often used because of its pure white color.
Oh, yeah.
Because people are assholes and like to take advantage of susceptible believers, there are, of course, another number of counterfeit relics.
Oh, and I talk about that in my story as well.
I do too. One of the most highly sought after relics is pieces of the true cross, which is supposedly wood from the cross that Jesus Christ was crucified on. Many churches made claim of having a piece of the cross, so many that John Calvin himself was noted as saying that there were enough pieces of the true cross to build a ship from them.
Okay, that's a good quote.
Yeah. By the 1650s or around there, there was such a large number of relics that it was hard to distinguish the real from the counterfeit. So the Catholic Church then divided them into three classes. The first class are items directly associated with the events of Christ's life or the physical remains of a saint. The second class are items that were owned or frequently used by saints. And the third class is any object that has been in contact with a first or second class relic.
Okay.
And there you have it. Some of the random information about relics.
Oh, gosh. Oh, and now you've given me a fun quote that I can use later in my first story. Okay, before I go into it,
that comes from South Park, the movie.
The thing you said about there's enough pieces of the true cross to build a ship. Well,
there's enough.
You'll probably get. Okay, y'all, this y'all, this puberty time. This Roadrunner Red is the best wine I've had in a long time.
I told you.
It's the perfect mix of sweet and not sweet.
It's from Deming, New Mexico.
So delicious. I love it. Okay, real quick, before I get into my first story, you know, my mom actually had a relic, and now I think my sister has it, and it's a chip of bone from a saint, and I don't remember who it was.
I think you told us this during...
Did I tell you that? And the reliquary is like a little, it's like a gold cross.
Yeah, they can be anything.
Yeah, but it's very pretty, so it's kind of like a, like maybe 8-10 inches tall, a foot tall. I'm trying to measure with my hand. And we always exaggerate, but it's got a little, and you can see a tiny little piece of bone in it. All right. So
speaking of inches
and penises, y'all. Okay. My first story is I'm talking about the holy prepuce or Jesus's foreskin. And yep, you heard that right. Jesus's foreskin is considered to be a relic,
and everybody and their mom claims to have one.
Yeah, exactly. There are enough Jesus's foreskins to make an actual Jesus. I don't know, but people believed that it actually exists. So I'm going to give a little bit of backstory.
I'm sure it did. I mean, he was Jewish, so it was practiced at the time.
Oh, and that's the perfect segue, because for history, all Jewish boys are required by Jewish law to be circumcised on the 8th day following their birth. Because Jesus was Jewish, the same would naturally go for him. And there's even, you know, quotes in the Bible about Jesus being circumcised. Now, the Feast of the Circumcision of Christ is still celebrated by many churches around the world. And I was like, wait a minute.
Sounds bizarre.
Listen
to this.
What do
you do on this feast?
You eat meat. No. You get like salami.
Loose meat sandwiches. Yeah, like Franz when Joey tried
That's
to make
exactly
himself.
That's what I'm thinking. You have like wraps.
This is fucking terrible.
This is awful. Okay. So y'all listen to this. I was like, this is tickling my brain, something about this. And I was like, churches celebrate it? Well, the feast is celebrated on January 1st because it's 8 days
New
after
Year's
Jesus
Day.
Was born. Exactly. Yeah. Well, in the Catholic Church, January 1st is a holy day of obligation. And for people who don't know what that is, very briefly, a holy day of obligation is an important feast day in the year where you have to go to church. Mm-hmm. It's like a mortal sin if you don't. So there were holy days of obligation throughout the year, and this is one. Well, I looked it up, and it's called the Solemnity of Mary. And I was like, that's what my mom would talk about. But the
I'm
actual...
sure your mom didn't want to talk about Jesus's foreskin.
No, she wrote about it. She didn't talk about it. Oh. No, but the holiday is an aspect of her motherhood and her having Jesus circumcised. Mm-hmm. So by calling it the Solemnity of Mary, you still celebrate the circumcision, but you
through
get to her title
eyes,
it.
Through
yeah,
her eyes. Through,
and so it's a way that maybe doesn't sound as obvious. Excuse me, I'm burping. So we celebrate it. But now let's get into the foreskin. So
Apparently, the foreskin survived the circumcision.
So you mean they don't call it Jesus' circumcision celebration? Or Jesus' bris?
Jesus' pre-puce.
No, bris.
Oh, it's Jesus' bris. Yeah, that's true.
Jesus' bris.
Jesus, welcome, Jesus' bris. Happy New Year.
Yeah.
So in addition, I already said that. The first reference to the survival of Christ's severed foreskin comes in the second chapter of the apocryphal Arabic infancy gospel, which contains the following story. And when the time of his circumcision was come, namely the eighth day, on which the law commanded the child to be circumcised, they circumcised him in a cave. And the old Hebrew woman took the foreskin and preserved it in an alabaster box of with an oil in it.
Yeah, of course.
Now, that box, I did not know this, but apparently Mary Magdalene, who was a huge thing throughout the Bible, she actually had this, and she poured forth the oil from that box onto the head and feet of Jesus.
Is that like that's when she, because she's the one that actually bathes call his feet.
Exactly. Even, so she would have
oils
used,
and she used her hair to clean his feet.
So can you imagine her being like, guess what this oil is made of, Jesus?
That is fucking weird.
Yeah, that's so weird. So because of all these stories, foreskin relics began appearing in Europe during the Middle Ages. The earliest recorded sighting came on December 25th in the year 800 when Charlemagne gave it to Pope Leo III when the latter was crowned the former emperor. Charlemagne claimed that it had been brought to him by an angel while he prayed at the Holy Sepulchre.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about this for a second. Could you imagine you're Charlemagne and you're praying and an angel floats down from heaven with a gift? Mm-hmm. And you're probably thinking, well, like, is this the Holy Grail or is this the Ark? Like, is this magic? Like, what is this? And you open like this old foreskin? Like, what would you think? I don't know, but I digress. So this story, the foreskin's authenticity was later considered to be confirmed by a vision of Saint Bridget of Sweden, who confirmed that it was somewhere in Rome. Y'all, Saint Bridget for just a second, because
of
like
Sweden,
all
to clarify.
Of Sweden, like all relics, the foreskin supposedly had magical powers.
Yeah.
And this is one of the first stories that got into it. So Saint Bridget had a vision in which she ate the foreskin.
Wow.
And this is what she wrote about it. She said, oh God, y'all, so great was the sweetness at the swallowing of this membrane that she felt a sweet transformation in all of her members, in the muscles of her members.
Wow.
Oddly enough, because the story, you think it can't get any weirder, she's not the only one to talk about eating it, because eating it or tasting it is what supposedly grants you the powers and or healing or whatever you would get from it. Now, the reason for eating it, not weirdly, is actually based in Catholic doctrine.
Oh, okay.
That consuming the flesh of Christ was and remains an important part of the Catholic doctrine.
That makes total sense.
Exactly. So you eat Christ's body, when you go to communion. So this is an extension or an appendage.
It is an
of
extension,
that.
Yeah, literally.
If you will. Oh, God. So I don't know, just eating it. Like, would you pair it with a wine?
Roadrunner
Red. Yeah,
Roadrunner
Red. Would it be a red or white wine? Okay. So if everyone's eating it, how was there enough to go around? And at first I was like, well, maybe people thought it was like the miracle of like the loaves and the fishes where some more just magically appears.
Or Jesus turning it into water into wine, kind of that thing.
Exactly. He's just mass producing his prepuce. But there were tons of foreskins, y'all. They're fakes all over the place.
I can imagine.
Yeah, because once
I mean, rabbis probably perform those like a million a day,
and keep a handful.
They probably make a suitcase out of one.
Oh, God, I didn't even think about that. Yeah. Huh, interesting. Well, as you know, way back then, churches, or if you don't know, churches could earn a lot of money from pilgrims who would pay money for these relics to be able to see them or touch them or
because they would
taste
take them,
them
and then move them, probably take them from town to town and probably.
Yep.
Show them off or make money that way,
and
too.
Then somehow a church ends up with one permanently, and then people come in to visit and they go to church and they tithe. So how do we know with thousands of fake foreskins, how do
which
we know
is
which is
one.
The real one? Well, the most accepted test of the veracity of the foreskin is a tasting. An expert said that a properly trained physician chosen by the local priest would taste the quote unquote shriveled leather in order to determine whether it was
even skin or holy or what? So,
but I mean, we have science now. Like, yeah. Can we do like some carbon dating and shit like that?
Well, okay. And that's a great question. And I'm going to get into that in one sentence. But first, I have to say that these people who consumed this mm-hmm. were known as croak prepuces. Now, finally, what about now? Like, what's going on now? Like, could you test it? Well, we don't know and we can't talk about it. The church noticed. Finally,
it's one of the many things that the Vatican is hiding, probably.
Well, they basically say it doesn't exist. But they actually realized that all the discussion of holy foreskins was becoming unintentionally amusing.
And out of hand.
So in 1900, Leo XIII issued an order that anybody talking about Jesus' foreskin could be thrown out of the church and excommunicated.
Because, I mean, it's like us nowadays who get... Tee-hee when talking about like poop jokes, you know?
Yeah.
So they're talking, oh, his foreskin, hee-hee.
Yeah. Tee-hee about it. Okay. My next short story will be shorter, but
and not
that
as
is
fucking insane.
Yeah, and not as insane, but that is a story of the prepuce.
Oh, God.
And so, I don't want to be blasphemous, but I'm sorry. I feel like Jesus is in heaven. Like, if Jesus exists, he's laughing about this because yeah. he's like, y'all were trying to collect my foreskin.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, go for it.
So, speaking of heads, in my first story, I'm talking about one of the most sought after Christian relics, the head of John the Baptist.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know it was like that sought after. Yeah. Okay, let's hear about it.
For those not familiar, John the Baptist was a Jewish preacher and prophet who has been celebrated as one of the earliest Christian saints who baptized Jesus in the River Jordan. According to the Bible and other texts, John the Baptist was killed under the order of a local ruler. The Bible says that he was beheaded with his head placed on a platter, with no clues as to what happened to the head or what happened to the rest of his body, for that matter.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. John the Baptist led a pious life in the desert, which led him to preach about the arrival of God's judgment. With that, he would urge his followers or anyone that would listen to repent their sins and be baptized in preparation. John himself stated he was not the coming Messiah, but instead foretold of the coming of Jesus. Since the late Roman, early Byzantine era, it has been believed that El Magadas in Jordan is the site where John baptized Jesus, and since 2015 has been added to the World Heritage List by UNESCO.
Oh, wow.
According to the documents, sometime after the infamous baptism that all other baptisms would model, John the Baptist was killed at Macarus, which is located near the Dead Sea in modern-day Jordan. So why was he beheaded? Well, according to the Gospels, Herod Antipas, son of Herod the Great,
mm-hmm.
had John the Baptist arrested and imprisoned after he said that Herod's marriage to his wife was illegal because she was previously married to his brother Philip.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Herod Antipas had a hard time killing John the Baptist due to his holy status, as I hope anybody would.
Like all the bullets miss and stuff?
Yeah, but then... At his birthday party, after Salome did a dance for him, Herod Antipas said he would give her anything she desired. She was prompted by her mother, who was spiteful due to John the Baptist's views on her marriage, to request John the Baptist's head on a platter.
Oh, God.
John the Baptist was then imprisoned for fear that John might start a riot or rebellion. And so he was beheaded. But again, what happened to his head and body? Documentation doesn't really state where John the Baptist was buried. Some 300 years after the event supposedly took place, John the Baptist's burial place was sought to be at Samaria, now in Palestine. But there have been a number of other places that claim where the saint's head is.
In Damascus,
Syria, a mosque was built on the site of a Christian church named after John the Baptist, where they say his head is buried in a shrine there. Then there's a skull on display at the church of San Silvestro in Capite, Rome, that has also been said to be that of John the Baptist.
They're just foreskins and heads just all over the world yeah. on display.
In Amiens, France, a cathedral is built in the 1200s to house the head of John the Baptist. The head was supposedly brought back there by a crusader from Constantinople in 1206.
Wow.
And lastly, in Munich, Germany, the Residenz Museum has claimed that they hold a skull among other relics collected by Duke Wilhelm V of Bavaria during the 1600s. Museums and monasteries across the world obviously just claim to have parts belonging to John the Baptist all over.
Oh, God.
Well, 11 years ago in 2010.
Oh.
Bulgarian archaeologists discovered a reliquary containing a number of bones in the ruins of a medieval monastery on a Black Sea island, which they thought to be the remains of John the Baptist. Inscribed on the side of the reliquary was in Greek, God,
these are the bones of John the Baptist.
No, God, save your servant Thomas, to St. John, June 24th.
Oh, wow.
And now for the disappointment. Radiocarbon dating and genetic testing on the remains have revealed that they belong to a man who lived around the first century in what is now the Middle East. That being said, it's still possible that this man was John the Baptist, but there's no way to actually prove the claim.
Sure.
So despite all the different places John the Baptist may be, we may just never know which is the real one. And that is the mysterious and fascinating story of the head of John the Baptist.
Wow, I didn't know it was such a thing. Like, once you told the story, I remember my mom saying, like, his head in a platter and stuff, but not that it was sought after and vanished for so long.
And my nerdism is going to come out. The way I understand and know the story is through the musical Sunset Boulevard.
What?
Because Norma Desmond does a scene as Salome. She dances the dance of the seven veils, and she wrote a screenplay, and she says, she kisses his mouth, she kisses his mouth, you know, like she kissed his mouth on the platter. It's like,
oh,
it's morbid as hell.
That is,
but it's from that movie and that musical that I know it from.
That is Ma, or Morbid as Hell. Mm. We have a new an acronym. Yeah. Is that what it is?
Sure.
Acronym. There we go.
Witchcraft. The occult, extremist beliefs, murder. Tune in to Rogue Darkness each week and join your host Raven as I uncover horrific crimes committed under the misconceptions and misunderstandings of witchcraft and other beliefs. I'll cover a plethora of crimes involving ritualistic killings to cult persuasion and everything in between. There's always three sides to a story. Side A, side B, and then the truth. Let's uncover the truth together and explore the darkness of mankind, one crime at a time. Available wherever you get your podcast fix, simply by searching Rogue Darkness.
All right, so next I am going to be talking about Veronica's veil. And the reason this came up, so this is a personal thing, is that in my mom's house, she had statues and pictures of everything religious. Well, there was one picture that was in her bedroom hanging up, and it was like a picture of Jesus's face, but he was wearing the crown of thorns and it's all bloody, and it was super creepy. And I remember it was the one picture that I refused to look at, as I would run through her room. I literally cover my eyes and run through it so I wouldn't have to look at it, just because it was really scary, like creepy. Well, that was one of the supposed images of Jesus's face from Veronica's veil. Uh-huh. So I thought everybody knew exactly what this was.
I've heard of it. I don't know what it is.
Because I found this out just in the last week, mm-hmm. that this is a big part of Catholic doctrine.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's not even in the Bible. And I don't know how it became such a big part of Catholic doctrine without being in the Bible, but it is. And
Catholics,
it's huge.
Do whatever the fuck they want. So.
Okay, that's actually fair. It's actually a part of the Catholic Stations of the Cross, which is such a huge thing.
I've been to the Stations of the Cross.
Yeah, and Veronica's Veil.
Like, there's just one.
Just one. I went to the station.
In San Luis, Colorado, where they have a huge, like, field of them, of the Stations of the Cross.
Oh, that would be like
but
my sister's.
San Luis, Colorado is also a lot of UFO shit happens in that area.
Is it? Oh, wow. So there's a lot of paranormal.
We should research on that.
That would be cool. We should. So for those of you who don't know, let me get into just the history is really short for this. According to legend, and this is what I grew up being told, there was a pious matron named Veronica who took pity on Jesus as he was carrying his cross through the streets of Jerusalem on the way to his crucifixion at Calvary. So she stepped forward from the crowd. So everyone else is scared, you know, scared to help Jesus. Well, she steps forward. She pulls out she takes her veil and she wipes Jesus' face. Yeah, wipes it off, you know, so he can see. Well, out of thanks for her kindness, Jesus worked a miracle and left a painting-like imprint of his face on the veil. So basically, whenever she looks at it, instead of just seeing a smear of blood and dirt, she basically sees the miraculous picture of Jesus' face. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's kind of similar to the Shroud of Turin, which actually was the spawn of this episode, and then neither of us ended up talking about it.
You were supposed to.
I know, I claimed it.
I have tests proving that.
But this one has an interesting thing about it. But they're often compared to each other, so at least if I wasn't Shroud, I was Shroud adjacent. And for those of you who don't know, the Shroud of Turin is the cloth that Jesus was supposedly buried in, and so it actually should have an imprint of his body.
Yep.
So the veil and the shroud are both around Jesus's crucifixion and death. So naturally, the veil is said to have mysterious powers. According to Catholic Online, Veronica kept the veil and discovered its curative properties. Mm. It's said that she cured Emperor Tiberius with the veil and then left it in the care of Pope Clement, the fourth pope, and his successors. Now, supposedly, it's been in their hands ever since, kept under lock and key in the Basilica of St. Peter. It's listed there as one of the most treasured relics. And I find it interesting that instead of using it to help and heal people, it was like, well, we got to lock this up, right? Now, one story, though, about the cloth says it showed the true face of Jesus one day during the Feast of the Epiphany in 1849.
So crazy.
On the third day of the feast, multiple parishioners saw the face in the veil take on vivid colors before it was bathed in a heavenly aura. The face of Jesus then became crystal clear for 3 full hours.
Wow.
Right? But here's the shit. Heinrich Pfeiffer, who is a professor of Christian art history at the Vatican's Gregorian University, says that the veil there at St. Peter's is only a copy. The original, he said, mysteriously disappeared from Rome in 1608, and the Vatican has been passing off copies as the original to avoid disappointing pilgrims. So again, we get into how many of this stuff, you know, really goes. Now, there's no real proof.
They just go to Joanne's Fabric and make...
They're like, cut, and they get a model, and they're like, well, how white does the model need to be?
Oh, my God.
And it's
gosh.
Like, well, it depends where we're at. If we're in America, he's got to be ginger. So there's no real proof of the veil, and I wasn't sure I was going to tell this story, but someone claims to have discovered the veil in 1999. So this is, you know, within the last 20 or so years, and this is actually really interesting.
All this stuff is very Indiana Jones, you know?
It really
the
is.
The Last Crusade.
Yeah, The Last Crusade. Yeah. It really is. But the person who discovered it is that same Heinrich Pfeiffer that I just talked about before, what? Who said it was a copy.
So he had his own copy.
So I actually thought of that. It was like, guys, this is a fake. Because look what's in my wallet. No, it's very true. So in 1999, he claimed to have found the real one.
That'd be the commercial. What's in your wallet?
What's in your wallet? The veil. So anyone could claim this, right? But this one actually has real supposed paranormal characteristics. After examining this veil, and it has been dated back to like being super, super old.
Like
experts.
You?
Huh. Well done. Well, experts contend that it possesses really unusual properties. Ooh. Measuring 6.7 by 9.4 inches, which is actually funny because how tiny is that?
Yeah.
It's like a little sock.
It's a handkerchief.
It's like a handkerchief, I guess. They say that the cloth is nearly transparent with reddish-brown marks that trace the face of a bearded, long-haired man. Now, the face becomes completely invisible depending on how light strikes it. Quoted, Pfeiffer said,
cool.
Do what?
It's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. It said, the fact that the face appears and disappears according to where light comes in can be considered a miracle. Also, it's quoted that this is not a painting. We don't know what the material is that shapes the image, but it appears to be blood. Now, how do we know it's not a painting? Well, experts have said that the cloth, the fact that whatever it's made out of, it's actually not possible to paint on the fabric. And finally, the image believed to be the face of Christ appears 100% identical on both sides of the cloth. And if you think about it, at the time of its creation, that's something that would have been impossible to do.
Absolutely.
They could not have done it. They couldn't have made it absolutely identical on both sides.
Yeah.
And so that is why they're claiming that this is actually, they finally found Veronica's veil.
That is cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know about that. So many relics that we talked about today were obviously Christians. So my second story, I found one that isn't.
Yay, I'm so glad.
I am talking about the Buddha's tooth. At the age of 80, the Buddha passed away not long after predicting his death was coming soon. He died of food poisoning.
Oh, wow.
Sometime around 543 BC, his body was burned on a pyre in India. Legend has it that after his body burned, the only thing left was his upper canine tooth, which, according to texts, a female disciple called Kima took. She then took the tooth to King Brahmadatta, along, although not a Buddhist, he accepted the gift.
Thanks for this tooth.
Yeah.
So generous.
The tooth was then placed in the village of Dhanatapuram, which it was said to remain for over 800 years.
Wow.
Side note, the name of the village actually translates to Tooth City. In the 4th century, a different king questioned worshipping of the tooth before himself converting to Buddhism. After his conversion, though, he began to persecute those who did not follow Buddhist teachings.
Oh, God.
A neighboring king who happened to be Hindu was displeased with the tooth worship. As a result, he sent a servant and an army to get a hold of the tooth. The servant was so overcome by the tooth that he himself converted to Buddhism.
I'm sorry. I'm just imagining becoming overcome by a tooth.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
This is the legend that he converted to Buddhism, but nonetheless, he brought it back to the king. The king then angrily demanded that it be thrown into the fire. Despite that, legend says that the tooth rose atop a lotus flower above the flames, emitting rays that ascended through the skies, illuminating the universe.
Holy shit. That's a bright tooth.
The king made other attempts to get rid of the tooth, but after many failures, he too was convinced of the power of the tooth and also converted to Buddhism.
Oh, wow.
He then had a temple built for the tooth, a stupa, as I said earlier. The tooth would eventually make its way back to the village that it came from, where yet another king would attack in an attempt to get a hold of that tooth. The king was defeated, but other attacks came to the village. As a result, the tooth was smuggled in secret out of the city in the hair of the king's daughter. Oh, where it made it to yet another king of Sri Lanka, where it remained until 1268.
Tooth has got some history. Holy shit.
When it moved to Kandy, I guess that's how you say it, the capital of Sri Lanka.
Okay.
Some 300 years later, colonization, overtook the kingdom and got their hands on the precious tooth, causing the king of Burma to put a hefty reward for its return. Despite this, a Catholic archbishop demanded that the tooth be burned, pulverized, and its dusty remains be thrown into the river. Legend has it that after all was said and done, the tooth miraculously again reappeared in a lotus flower safely back in its previous resting place.
Wow.
The tooth then remained there until the British overtook the city, taking the tooth with them. And this is where the story became a little unclear, but somehow the tooth found its way back to Kandy again, where it remains to this day.
Oh, so it still supposedly
exists. I think what happened is that the British took it, but then they somehow smuggled it out and then brought it back.
Yeah. In more hair. Okay.
Yearly, there's a 10-day festival that occurs in July or August called Isala Perahera in Kandy, in which there is a procession through the city of worship is praying to the tooth in hopes that it will rain for 10 days before the full August moon.
Wow, I want to go.
The next festival will take place on August 14th through 24th, 2021. Like I said before, when it comes to relics, many places lay claim to having the original. Well, in Rosemead, California, there is a tooth that they claim is the Buddha's tooth. I mention this for the crazy fact that in 2013, an article came out stating that the Buddha's tooth that lays there was said to continue growing.
The tooth grew?
Yeah.
How big did it get?
A monk is quoted as saying, "The tooth, already four times the length of the average human tooth,
what?
Is continuing to grow because of its special powers." The tooth's authenticity, of course, can't be confirmed.
Yeah.
Despite that, there have been some weird occurrences with this one. First, some baby bird supposedly sensing something in there tried to peck their way into the room where it was laid. It was also reported that the tooth gave off a strong, pleasant odor, which a specialist in Buddhist relics said is a common for those kind of relics.
Oh,
which
wow.
Is also an attribute of incorruptibles, if you remember our episode far back.
That's right.
And there you have it, a couple of connected and bizarre stories about the Buddha's tooth.
OMG, that was amazing. That was a journey.
That tooth has taken a journey.
That tooth has been around the block. Yeah. Oh, I'm just imagining like in 20 years, the one in California is going to be like a tree.
It's going to be an elephant trunk.
I'm imagining it was one of those things you put in water and it just like grows.
Like those dinosaurs
and
stuff?
Yeah, and it's just a Buddha's tooth. That, you could sell that. Yeah. Grows in water. How did it end up in California?
Well, That one, I think they got donated to them from some place. I can't remember. I don't remember completely, but yeah, they got it donated to a specific Buddhist temple in that town.
From Buddha Tooth LLC.
Yeah.
Wow, that is amazing. Yeah. That is such a cool story.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I love this episode, by the way. So now we're on to Believer Skeptic.
Yeah.
So for the debunk, I'm not going to be talking about the prepuce because, I mean, what's there to say, right? I am going to be talking about, there's a lot to say, that's true. But as far as debunking, I think it kind of debunks itself. I'm going to be talking about Veronica's veil. So the veil of Veronica makes for a really wonderful story of human compassion, right? But it's pretty possible that not only did the veil not exist, that Veronica herself didn't exist. This is something I didn't know, that not only is she never mentioned in the New Testament, and that's why I was like, how did the story even happen?
Yeah,
like, where did it come from? I don't know. But the name Veronica in itself is super suspect to a lot of scholars. They say that the Latin translation of Veronica is broken down into vera for true and icona for meaning image. So Veronica means true image. Doesn't that sound a little too perfect?
That sounds fishy.
It sounds very fishy. So along the way, it sounds like the phrase true image was attributed to a woman who wiped the face of Jesus. So it's one of those things where they kind of made up the story and then gave her the perfect name in hindsight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's why scholars are like, this woman isn't even in the Bible. How does she even have this name?
Yeah.
Well, so the Vatican claims that there are records of a woman who was there when Christ was crucified. And scholars have found that there is a character in the gospel, and it was a woman who was cured of a hemorrhage by touching a section of Christ's robe, I guess, as he was being crucified. Yeah, so who's to say that maybe that wasn't Veronica? Well, it has been noted by other scholars that these records are composed with very strange irregularities in style and structure, as if written by numerous people instead of just one. Yeah. So all these irregularities have prompted some question as to the authenticity of these documents. Because if you have so many people contributing, it becomes a telephone game.
Yeah.
And at what point does it become the fact where people are just making stuff up to
substantiate miracles? That's where we get a lot of our mythology, too. You know, that's how mythology happens.
Yep, absolutely. So that's kind of what they're saying here. Now, y'all, this is a little personal thing. I've seen the picture. I'm going to post it of the true image of Veronica's veil that this Heinrich guy. And y'all, it looks like something like a seventh grade art student would draw.
It looks like that. Remember how that lady tried to redo that religious painting?
Yes, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm sorry, y'all. This is my personal belief, but if Jesus were to bless a miracle of a veil,
it would look
pretty good. Yeah. I'm like, really? Like, this is it? Yeah, it's sus. It's a little like, ugh, it totally looks like that picture.
Yeah.
And that is my debunk.
Well, my believer is a little short. I find relics very interesting in the sense that most anything can be a relic unless you are Catholic, then it must fall under the aforementioned categories. But I digress. I do think religious relics are sacred and have their own power in the same sense that things like saints, crystals, pentacles, or other spiritual objects do.
Oh, yeah.
In the article about the Buddha's tooth in California, the expert in Buddhist relics says that, quote, fact-checking in Buddhist worship is not the most important factor in discerning whether a relic is really from the body of the sacred Buddha. It's what the believer witness while in its presence.
Interesting.
How people react to them, that's where the real test is.
Huh.
I tend to agree with her in the sense that if you're having a positive reaction to something such as a relic, you are inclined to believe it works. And as we said before on here a million times, if it's not hurting anyone, then what is the harm in that? For example, the santuario near my hometown, which I mentioned earlier, people would go there just to scoop out dirt from the holy ground, which some have claimed have helped them or healed them altogether. And although not a relic, it is the same concept in that it brings a comfort to the person who is seeking it out. As the same Buddhist relic scholar says, what's sacred is in the eye of the beholder.
Nice. That's nice. I figured that you would believe in something around this.
Yeah.
And that's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So do we have a
listener story this week, so that is your hint to get your stories in.
Come on,
ASAP.
People.
So
please.
Anyhow, I found an article from 3 days ago, which I would say is kind of feel-good story. Homeland Security investigations in 2017 learned of the illegal exportation of two relics from Thailand. There were two stolen hand-carved relics that were prominently displayed at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco for over 50 years.
Hand-carved relics. Okay.
The two sandstone muzzles dating back to the 9th and 10th centuries were stolen and exported from Thailand, which is highly illegal in Thailand, then donated to the city of San Francisco. In February of this year, a settlement was reached with the city and county of San Francisco, who agreed to give up the relics. The relics have now been returned to Thailand during a repatriation ceremony that occurred on June 1st in Los Angeles. The relics, called lintels, will now be displayed on exhibition in Thailand.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really nice.
Yeah. So.
Wow. So this was a.
a journey.
Oh, my gosh. It makes me so happy. And I've said this. I feel like we've gotten so many good episodes lately. And it just makes me happy that. Even after 3.5 years, that we're still finding stuff like this. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And speaking of, this is our 98th episode, which we are two away from 100.
Hey!
So our 100th episode will come out in August at the beginning of our fifth year. And it will be very special. But as a preface to that, we would like to invite all our listeners to either email us, well, email us either way, but send us either a voice memo or just a note that we can read, just celebrating our 100th episode. So just send us something and we'll compile that all together so we can preface that to our 100th episode.
And it can be anything you want. If there's a moment or just something you want to say, absolutely anything at all. If you want to make fun of us.
Yeah. And if you, like I said, if you want to record it and send it, or if you want to email it, we can read it. Either way will work for us.
Absolutely.
And you can do that by sending it to bspodphx@gmail.com. That's bspodphx@gmail.com. You can also find us on all your podcatchers, wherever you find podcasts, by just searching bspodphx. And as always, until January, I am still raising money for the St. Jude's Research Hospital, Children's Research Hospital, for my half marathon come January. So, yeah.
That's exciting. Yeah, donate. And then, and if you like the podcast, there is no greater gift that you can give than recommending it or telling a friend about it.
Yeah.
So we would really appreciate that. And then finally, my books, The Gay Teen's Guide to Defeating a Siren, as always, are available on Amazon for any LGBTQ interested readers.
Because it is Pride Month.
It is Pride. Oh, yeah. It is Pride Month.
Yeah. And that being said, next month, July, we don't have the exact date yet, but we are again participating in Pride 48, which is a live stream of us for an hour. Once we have the exact date and time, we will let you know about that.
Exactly. And it's so much fun. Yes. Oh, my gosh. We have the best time. So check that out.
Yeah.
And let us know what you thought about this episode, because dang, that was fun.
Yeah.
And everyone have whatever you believe in. If you have any relics, actually tell us about them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We would love to hear your relic stories, but we are going to let you go now. So we'll send you love and hugs and bye.
See you again next time.